You're with Richard Glover on ABC Radio Sydney.
On Drive yesterday, Professor Tom Carmer was speaking about the Indigenous voice to Parliament and how there was a practical utility, not only a moral case, but a practical utility in listening to First Nations voices, particularly on issues which affect that community. He gave the example of COVID-19 and how Indigenous leaders had stepped up to direct the response and had, as a result, achieved enormous success. Here he is with us yesterday.
We've seen through the whole COVID process, less than 150 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have a COVID infection and no known deaths. And that can't be said anywhere else in the world and with other population groups in Australia.
Yeah, that's Tom Carmer with me yesterday. So in practice, how was it done? In a moment, you'll hear from Indigenous activist and lawyer Teela Reid, who set up a Facebook page, did battle with her own relatives, and also from the public health expert and former Australian of the Year, Professor Fiona Stanley. But first to Dr. Dawn Casey. She's Deputy CEO of the National Aboriginal Controlled Community Health Organisation, and she joins us here on Drive. Dawn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Richard.
You know, first of all, it's important to call out the success, isn't it? As Tom has done, you've been incredibly successful.
Yes, that's absolutely right. People were ready back in the end of January, February last year for when they first heard of the COVID virus coming, you know, around the world. So, you know, we had our first meeting, the joint Commonwealth State COVID Advisory Committee meeting on the 5th of March, but we'd already been planning to meet before then to address a whole lot of issues, like think about the flu vaccination and then COVID, how are we going to deal with this? So they were all ready. And it wasn't just leaders. It was workers on the ground, health workers, Aboriginal doctors who were leaders, and they'd all, with their corporate memory and their memories of how the flu has had a major impact in communities, how the mumps years ago in North Queensland, the major impact that it had. So they were just all ready, you know, to go.
One of the really exciting ideas, I think, here is that one of the things that really drove the passion early on was this particular idea about the importance of elders, that they're living historians. I mean, they are in all communities, but Indigenous people have got onto the idea that they're living historians and they're terribly important. And the idea that you might lose those people really galvanised people.
Yes, I think that, well, we've always respected elders, and elders have led the way in a whole range of traditional practices. They hold our stories in the dreaming, the language. So that's always been recognised by our communities, and therefore to protect them was of the utmost importance. Mm. And that was drawn out in COVID, in the response to COVID, and all through the last year, including, you know, feeding people. So health services got caught up in where people were running out of food, mental health issues that happened during extensive lockdown periods in Victoria. So everything came to the fore in terms of that areas that normally health services haven't a bit of a contribution to make, but they were the centre of everything, as should have been the case, really.
We're talking to Dr. Dawn Casey about this world-class response to COVID, really led by Indigenous leaders, reaching out to the non-Indigenous leaders, you know, people like the Prime Minister and the Premiers and so forth, and seeing how they thought this should be done. And it sounds like you were listened to. It began, didn't it, in March with you and Pat Turner reaching out to people like the Prime Minister and saying, use your powers to close off these remote communities.
That's true. Well, Pat led that together with Central Australian Community Health Service and the Kimberley. We do need to close the borders and stop people from coming in. So that was initiated by the group of leaders, including land councils, to let's close the borders, lock borders down so people can't bring in this infection. And then people on the ground in the health services had already started planning how are we going to protect people from a health perspective.
And it even came down to detail, didn't it, that you, with the help of Woolworths and people like that, got food delivered to communities so that people didn't need to go to town to do their shopping.
Yes, that certainly happened in a lot of places. But I think that, you know, the most important aspect really in those early stages, very, very early stages, was the local community controlled health services making sure that the messaging about social distancing and all of that went out immediately. And based on the guidelines that had been developed by this joint advisory committee, they adapted those guidelines into what was understandable sort of messages on the ground. And there were some hilarious ones and great messaging in the use of a whole range of medium to do that. So that was really, really critical as well to the issues. And people did, it's so true that Woolworths, and we certainly had donations to Nacho to help people purchase PPEs and hand sanitizers, because there were shortages of that earlier on in the piece.
Yeah. What happens when Indigenous people are actually allowed to control the things that are affecting Indigenous people? Well, it turns out in this example they did, and in this example the result has been a world-class outcome in terms of COVID for Indigenous Australians. The figures, basically 150 Indigenous people contracted COVID. There have been no deaths, touch wood, no COVID-19 contracted in remote communities at all. Only 20 hospitalisations in this community, this particularly vulnerable community. Professor Fiona Stanley, of course, former Australian of the Year, public health expert, she's on the line alongside Dawn Casey and Teela Reid. Fiona, good afternoon to you.
Thank you very much, and hello, Dawn, and hello, Teela.
I'm so pleased
you're raising this as an issue, because this should be being shouted from the rooftops. There is just absolutely no other population in the world that has done as well as our First Nations population. It's been led by them. I mean, Dawn's outlined the fantastic response, but they were at very high risk, Richard. You know, this is a, you know, going on the H1N1 flu of 2009, we would have expected 1,000 cases at least, a large number of deaths, intensive care need and all the rest of it. Because of their years of neglect and poor health status, chronic disease, and we knew from both Italy and China that this was much more contagious and it was likely to get people with comorbidities, which is just the kind of risks that our First Nations have. And, of course, their poor health literacy and the fact that they don't have access to good health care across the nation. And so these guys just swung into action. And I'll give you the data. Can I do that? Or do you want
to? Of course.
Look, so there were 27,750 cases across Australia. And we would have anticipated, since 3% of the population are Aboriginal, at least would have been 850. There were actually 148. I don't think there's 150 yet, 148. And that the rate for non-Indigenous people was 1.1 per thousand people. The rate for First Nations was 0.19 per thousand people. That is a six-fold difference. That means that we're much more likely, six times more likely, to get COVID-19 than our First Nations populations. That is a dramatic reversal of the gap, what I like to point out. No deaths, as you say, no cases in remote communities, not one. No cases after the Black Lives Matter marches. And the way that they did this was across the board in every single way. They were prepared. They got good data. The data sovereignty movement that's going across Australia, the Indigenous data sovereignty movement, beautifully demonstrated by this COVID response. As Dawn's referred to, I think the best media I've ever seen in terms of COVID was put out by the First Nations across the nation. Some of them were hilarious, but they were very, very good. So, in fact, I would have thought, from having very poor health literacy, our First Nations then were absolutely tops in terms of getting why they had to socially isolate, why they had to have these activities, and looking after, as you say, the populations. And, of course, they're at high risk because of the poor housing and the overcrowding and all of those things. And so it was a magnificent response, and it's a really good evidence, if you need it, that giving a voice to Aboriginal people is the solution to their issues and problems. If we could implement and continue to implement the support for the Aboriginal-controlled community health services and the other Aboriginal health service, Aboriginal services across the nation, this is the way to go. You can't snap back to a situation where decisions are being made for Aboriginal people without them. So it's a terrific example of why it's so cost-effective to have a voice enshrined in the Constitution.
Professor Fiona Stanley, former Australian of the Year, public health expert, is with us. So is Dr. Dawn Casey, who's the Deputy CEO of the National Aboriginal Controlled Community Health Organisations, which have been absolutely central to this. And I want to ask Dawn in a second about whether it was difficult to have their voices heard by the non-Indigenous authorities, you know, the Prime Ministers and the Premiers. But first, let's bring in Teela Reid, human rights advocate and lawyer. And she was part of this response on a more grassroots level, I suppose. And she joins us in the studio. Hi, Teela.
Yama. Thanks for having me.
You really use things like Facebook to reach out to the people in the community you knew personally, your relatives, your friends.
Yeah. So when COVID hit, it was really scary for many people because there were mixed messages, particularly from the federal parliament and state parliament. There was really confusing messaging. What I thought was so important and a lot of other mob was immediately we needed to lock down our communities and protect our eldership because our elders are our lifeline. I'm from a little community in Western New South Wales, Gilgandra. You know, we don't even have a Woolworths out there. It's so tiny.
And but the one at Tamworth's 24 hours.
You know, it was about trying to, I created a Facebook page. You know, lots of country towns have these signs when you're going in. I edited our sign and was like, Gilgandra is on lockdown. And so I invited all of my cousins and my aunties and suddenly the group just exponentially grew. And, you know, it was about first and foremost, I remember calling my nan and being, Nan, do not leave your house. And she's like, oh, I'm just going down to see Auntie so-and-so. I'm like, no, you can't do that. Anyway, within the next 24 hours, we'd convinced her to kind of rang back and she's like, oh, I've got a lock and bolt in my door now. But, you know, I think part of the you know, getting family around and delivering the same messaging and a lot of the culturally appropriate communication that came out of places like Nacho were really relevant to the way in which our mob communicates.
Okay, so using humour as an example, isn't it?
Yeah, but also, you know, the photos and the pictures and the messagings that they had were just really, you know, it reflected mob. Delivering a message. And part of that, when I had created the page, all of my community essentially come on board and the local council picked up the page. And so from that, the local council in my community were like, okay, they'd got a list of all the elders in the community and were delivering then essential things that they needed to their front door or to their gates. So that was part of kind of mobilizing and ensuring that when the elders were locked down, that they also had their essential needs met.
I know you're very proud of your Aboriginality, but does this make you particularly proud? Is this something that's being talked about within, as you say, the mob that you have done collectively incredibly well, this world-class thing?
I just think we know as mob, we have the answers in our communities and every community has a different response to their issues. And I think that with respect to COVID-19, it was just such a clear example of how we know what is best at the local level for our community, which is essentially what the Voice to Parliament calls for. Allow these people at the grassroots level to speak to and for the solutions in their community. And we know that mob had the solutions.
Yeah, a case study. Dr. Dawn Casey, was it hard to be heard? We say, you know, you reached out and said what you wanted done. Were people listening?
Elements that made it quite easy for governments to listen. One was the issue that Pat Turner, our CEO, had been pursuing for a couple of years, and that was the Coalition of Peaks, the national agreement with government. And so, and that was achieved halfway through last year, but she'd been negotiating with the Prime Minister himself and premiers around the country, so that was on track to take place in the middle of last year, that whereby programs and Aboriginal organisations who deliver services need to be in joint partnerships in designing their programs and listened to, etc. So that had been on track. And then for NACHO itself, I'd been working on the congenital syphilis program since 2017, when the government had not addressed that. It had been going on for 11 years, and it was finally brought to the attention of the Chief Medical Officer by Minister Wyatt. And so we were working on that, and there was a bit of a spat at the end of a year when we're trying to line up all the ducks and between Commonwealth and state. And I said, look, you know, we're fed up with this sort of nonsense. I'm going to go and work with ARCHOs to see develop the models that they see in their communities, how we can address this congenital syphilis outbreak. So we'd been working with Brendan Murphy, who was then Chief Medical Officer, together with another chap who's Dr. Lucas Dutoka, and they'd seen the results of if you work with people on the ground, what that can achieve. And so there was just absolutely no fuss about going in with a co-chairing, incorporating Aboriginal medical directors and doctors and Aboriginal health workers and ARCHOs, because they'd seen the evidence of what that can achieve if you develop the programs on the ground. So there was no hesitation at all. And what was even made easier and simpler was the allocated funding to NACHO, and we were able to get the grants out within a couple of weeks. So not prohibitive red tape. And we're doing the same with the rollout of the vaccine now. So, you know, it was people who knew what ARCHOs could do on the ground.
Yep. Well, look, it's very warming to see that this actually worked and that you were listened to and that it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of the fact that this was already working. Let me go finally back once more to Professor Fiona Stanley. I suppose what Dawn is saying is understand that this is part of a whole process of in this particular case, health measures. Tom Carmer made the same point yesterday. He said you can also look at non-smoking campaigns. When they're run by Indigenous people, they work. When they're imposed on the community, they don't.
We've got lots of evidence on this, Richard. You know, I've been working in collaboration with Aboriginal researchers for 30 years, and we've got so much data to show that when Aboriginal people control and because they understand the context in which their people are living. I mean, Tila, to say that everyone knew where those elders were, well, that's exactly what had to happen, because the local services know where they are and who they are and can immediately implement the best preventive strategies for them. So when you give First Nations people this power, it works every time. And some of it works, I'm afraid to say this, is because we've failed to understand what First Nations people need. We've had years of neglect and marginalisation and poor services, and much of what's been implemented with huge cost has not been done in collaboration with First Nations, who really do. Even every community I've been to knows what to do. So all we need to do is set partnerships up, fund them appropriately, build their capacity, and let them bloody well get on with it, because it's going to succeed.
Well, let's go. Let's end with your data again, Fiona, because it's just amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is.
You said 1.1% of, didn't you, of Australians had contracted COVID?
1.1 per thousand.
1.1 per thousand. Yeah.
Thousand. And for Indigenous, it's 0.1. per thousand. I mean, it's dramatically different. And I don't know why we're not singing this from the rooftops. And I was talking to Dawn and others and saying, you know, if this had been the other way around and there are lots of Aboriginal people dying, as happened with H1N1 and the high rates, it'd be all over the newspapers. I mean, the poor Navajo, the Brazilians in Canada, in North America, it's been disastrous for First Nations. And here's Australia leading the bloody world, and nobody wants to know about it. Why not? Sorry to get so passionate.
No, you've helped sing it from the rooftops, which is exactly what we wanted to do. And Dawn Casey has sung it from the rooftops.
The final point to make about what everyone has said is that First Nations know what's best for their community. So for everyone listening who can support the movement for First Nations to continue having a voice, there's a week of action coming up on the 22nd to the 26th of March. Go to Uluru Statement. government.org, sign up your support and ensure that the government listens when First Nations say they want a voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution.
And Dawn, what we've learnt today, if we didn't know it already, it is, of course, a moral issue, but it's also a kind of, there's a great thing about Australians, we're a practical people, and if you want practical outcomes, this works, doesn't it?
Yeah. So people, I think greater Australians need to recognise that. I mean, the problem is that we do have a huge backlog out there in the Aboriginal community in terms of housing, which contributes significant, poor housing, which can contribute significantly to poor health. There's just terrible conditions out there. So, you know, other Australians need to encourage the government to spend money in these places so that downstream we're saving on a whole series of health measures, et cetera. And so fully recognise that Aboriginal people know what they need, know how to do it, but they haven't got the money to do it. So that's, it's really important to fund programs.
All right. Well, we dips our lid to you and Pat and to people more at the grassroots like Teela who have created this world-class result. Congratulations and thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Dr. Dawn Casey is the Deputy CEO of the National Aboriginal Controlled Community Health Organisation, working with Pat Turner, who's the boss there. Teela Reid has been in the studio with me, human rights advocate and lawyer. And thanks also to Professor Fiona Stanley, public health expert and former Australian of the Year, who allowed us to put this in an international context and just see the amazing thing that has been achieved in this country.
Drive on ABC Radio Sydney.